So Frank, I've heard you talk so many times about this economic charter of rights, and in a practical sense, like, how does it work? How does it work for the average guy that just wants to understand, that doesn't understand necessarily the economy in detail, but, you know, wants to understand a little bit more about, you know, what you're trying to convey?
Well, basically what it boils down to is that the divide between the very rich and the working class gets bigger and bigger. So we got to take a look, how come, why is that way? So we have to realize the world has always been dominated by the golden rule. Who has the gold or the money makes the rules, right? So I personally don't want to be dominated by anyone. If I feel that strong, I should not be able to dominate somebody either, because I started in a garage, right, and built up a huge company with about 180,000 employees. And so I didn't want to dominate those employees. I looked at them as partners, right? So the question is, the real question is, how can we dismantle the chains of dominations? Not via violent revolutions, via a revolution of the mind. And the revolution of the mind would lead to what I would say an economic charter of rights.
Okay. And if we're talking through an economic charter of rights here, you've got a program that I've heard you talk about, 6-7 point program. Is that what you're talking about when you talk about the economic charter?
Well, yeah, the economic charter of rights, I tried to leave it as simple as possible to find consensus, right? Because any time when you have a lot of rules, it's very difficult to find consensus. You always have somebody, this isn't right, or that isn't right, or it's got it. So I tried to leave it as simple as possible, right? And so it's based on 7 principles. But the primary reason there is, I've noticed and I've experienced it, when you have a conversation, might it be with the politicians or business people or people in general, they all agree on one thing. If the economy doesn't work, nothing else will work. So it's the economy, the economy, the economy. Because if the economy doesn't work, you cannot feed the hungry. You cannot look after the most fragile people, the elderly, the sick and the handicapped. So it's the economy. And it amazes me that we don't talk more about the economy, right? Because the economy is the most important aspect in a society, right? So we don't talk at all what drives the economy.
Yeah, and I think for young people, or with respect to the economy, I would say that is it too complex for the average man to understand? When you say the economy, it's a big, what's the economy? I don't know. Does it function? Is it business? Is it people? Is it politicians? You know, if you're talking to somebody and says, you know, it's the economy, the economy, the economy. What is the economy? How can we understand that in simple terms?
That's exactly what I was trying to do, to kind of formulate it in simple terms, that it's easily understood. The economy is driven by 3 forces, okay: smart managers, hardworking employees, and investors. So that's an easy formula, all right? That's what drives the economy. So if that is the case, so basically the message I want to get across loud and clear is that without employees, without workers, you can't make a profit.
Agreed.
So I'm saying, workers have a moral right to some of the profits. So that's the essence of the economic charter of rights. Okay? And it doesn't mean, we're not preaching that we want to take away from the rich. But all what I'm saying is, if workers, workers should get a piece of the economic pie, you know, without, so the workers are part of making an economic pie, and they should get a piece of it, right? And I think that's so logical. I think it's simple, but it seems the very rich don't want to share the profits with the workers. I think that's the dilemma.
And maybe you can help us understand, how does sharing, you're speaking to the rich here, how does sharing profits help the economy?
Well, it would help the economy enormously. Life is really, you go through in phases. It's an evolutionary process. So when I look way back, right, to the caveman, and then he had the hunter and the hunted, and then afterwards he had the kings and the servants. And now we have an environment, what I will call the bosses and disgruntled employees, okay? So the reason I've done so well and built that, you know, it's a lot of people, it's difficult for them to understand that can somebody build a company with 180,000 employees? I treated every time I went to work, every day, I always ask myself, what do I have to do that workers respect me? So that was always, right? And so I really should start out. Again, it was an evolutionary process, right? And 1955, I arrived in Toronto with a couple of $100. I didn't know anybody, and I found a job fairly quickly in a tool and die shop. I'm a tool maker by trade. Like, tool making means, let's say those glasses are here, not made by hand. Hey, you need machines and for everything here, or the microphone, mm-hmm. or a bumper of a car, right, or the door of a car. You need a tool that you can make that. So I've done that. So I found the job in a small company, then employees. After a few months, the owner said to me, "Frank, you're doing a great job. I want you to be a partner of mine." My chest swelled a little, and that's pretty nice. He was a nice guy, but he never wrote it down. So I said to myself, there's nothing to it to run a business. I looked in the papers, tool makers wanted. I got a job, which had much higher pay. So in 2 years later, I had $5,000 saved up. In 57, $5,000 is a big amount. You could buy a small house or a small farm with that money. So anyway, so I started out, and I rented the gatehouse of Standard American, that's in Toronto, and the two major streets down the corner is Dufferin and DuPont. And so anyway, so I started out, and I bought a bunch of used equipment, right? And I started out, I went in the factories, and I said, I'm very good in solving problem. If I can't solve the problem, you don't have to pay me. So anyway, after 1 month, I hired somebody. After a year, I had about 10 people. After 2 years, I had 20 people. And then the first evolution sets in. I had actually a German fellow as a foreman. His name was Herman. And I said to him, "Herman, what's the matter with you lately?" "Well," he said, "Frank, I'm thinking of starting my own business." I said, "I sympathize with that." So that evening, I was talking to myself. I said to myself, if that farmer's going to leave me, that would stifle my growth. Not a very good deal. What I really didn't like, if that farmer's going to leave me, I got to do all the work myself. I liked it even less. The third reason was, if I hire a new foreman and I don't show him how business is run, I still got to do all the work. And if I hire a new foreman and I show him how business is run, he would leave and start his own business another year too, right? So anyway, the next day, the next morning, I said to Herman, "Herman, why don't we open up a new factory? You own 1/3, I own 2/3. By the end of the year, we take some monies out, and we'd leave some monies in for growth." So Herman said, "Do you mean it?" I said, "Yes." We went right away to a lawyer. And we signed a contract, and Herman was hustling. That was his factory, right? He was so proud, right? I mean, so I said to myself, business is easy. So I took the next foreman next year, another foreman a few years. I took six more foremen. I had seven factories gone, and we had a cash flow like crazy.
Right, right.
And I saw this big market out there.
Right.
You know, the multi-billion dollar market, you know, in the car industry. So I said to myself, how can I get the workers involved, right? So I got a lot of thinking, a lot of asking, and I came to the conclusion I should convert the private company to a public company, which I did. And I put in a corporate constitution. The main principle of the constitution was I predetermined what we do with the profits. So 20% of the profits went to the shareholders in the form of a dividend. 10% went of the profits went to the workers over and above their wages. 6% went to management. 7% went to research, and 2% went to charity. So about 50% was left over for taxes and new investments, right? So anyway, the interesting part was the first year profits climbed 40% when I got the workers involved. And the second year, he climbed to 100%. And the third year, 200%. Incredible. So basically, I stumbled or I created something. When you get the workers involved in a tangible way, it is amazing the energy you create. Because workers on the front line, they can see things, how to make things better, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the message I want to get across. Look, without workers, you can't make a profit. If they participate, you make more monies. Everybody makes more monies. And one of the seven principles is a country should not have any debt, huh? And so basically, I recommend the number one principle that Canada should pay its debt back in 20 years, right?
Right.
So we could very easily do it if we get workers involved.
Right. And how does that, what's that tangibility between getting workers involved and paying back debt? How does that work?
Well, that means If workers are involved, you're more productive. You make more monies.
Yes.
The company pays more taxes. The workers, basically, governments make most of the tax money is made by income.
Bingo.
Tax, right?
Yes.
Okay, so automatically, I think if we would focus on that, we would pay back the debt in 5 years or in 10 years,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And be debt-free.
Interesting. So one of the things I'm picking up here, and that I've heard you talk a lot, of course, over the years, you seem to have entered your entrepreneurship with a mindset of abundance rather than scarcity. And I think talking to a young entrepreneur, what do you have to say to these young entrepreneurs that are scared that they finally get the business going and they finally start to make money, and then they want to take that money and maybe not necessarily share it with their employees after they've worked so hard to finally earn it? So how do you think you ended up with this abundance mindset, and how does that transfer to the young generation?
It's quite simple. Usually I talk to young people or entrepreneurs. I say, focus on today to stay alive. But leave the door open for tomorrow and follow your dreams and be guided by your conscience. Because we all have dreams, right? But we should have a conscience too. If you make the monies, you know, you have a right to use some of that knowledge you accumulate for your own personal use, but also society should benefit from it.
Right. So you've got a small business, 30, 40 employees now, and you're talking to, and that business is saying, wow, like, you know, Astronic, he's got that amazing profit sharing formula, but it's so complex. You know, what do you recommend to the business that has 5, 10, 30 employees? How do they get the employees involved?
Yes, and again, I'm reflecting when I started out. I said early on, I had 10 employees, then 20, and then maybe a couple of hundred, right? The essence is part of the 7 principles. I said the number one principle is we should pay back debt.
Yes.
Okay. The number two principle is we have to be concerned. We should try to lower the bureaucracy, right? Mm-hmm. Because basically, I can work in a factory, and I don't have to look at the books, and I can see if that company makes monies or loses monies. By simply looking, if there's more people in the offices and less people on the factory floor, that company will make no monies.
Right.
Okay, and that's the same holds true with governments, right? If we have more and more bureaucrats than working people, then it can't work. And when you look in history, the company, the countries with the lowest bureaucracy have the highest living standards. So again, the whole thing is we got to be civilized. I'm not saying it's the bureaucrats' fault. I'm saying it's the fault of the system, right? I mean, in a civilized country, every citizen got the right to find a job, whatever the openings are. So I'm not blaming the bureaucrats, right? The only thing I'm saying, look, the harder you work, the more bureaucrats you create. So slow down. If you don't go to work, it's be better, right? The less bureaucrats we have.
Yes.
But that's, you got to kid a little, always do, right? To look at it from the lighter side. But so basically, I'm saying the idea is not to lay off bureaucrats, okay? Nobody should be afraid of. But we should be guided by, what's the right proportion, right? So I just looked at some statistics. I got 3 countries in mind. Canada had 100 bureaucrats per 1,000 people.
Okay.
The United States had 70 bureaucrats per 1,000 people. And Japan had 40 bureaucrats per 1,000 people. And I still think if you would take a closer look, even the one in Japan is maybe on the high side, right? So I could say, look, with 30 bureaucrats, I think we could run a pretty good ship, right? So that's the number two principle. We gotta reduce the bureaucracy in a civilized way, right? And we should also think when we talk about bureaucrats, when you know a civilized society needs some bureaucrats, we have to lay down food safety or building safety or medical safety, right? Okay, but we are not taking. When we look back in history, societies had wise councils. We haven't got that anymore. So, but we would have many, many wise councils, because in Canada we have a lot of smart business women, a lot of smart business men, and they would be very happy when it gets close to retirement to say, gee, I would love to serve the country. I would love to be on a committee. Might it be the food processing? Might it be the building? You know, when it comes down to building, because you're in the building industry, you know better than I do, right? Basically, you need engineers. Is the snow load okay? Is the wind load okay? Is the sewage thing okay? Bingo. You have a permit, right?
Yes.
That's the way it was 40, 50 years ago.
Yes.
Now it would take you months and months to get a permit.
Maybe years. So I just want to bring this to fruition and make sure that I'm going to articulate it clearly for any of your viewers. So it's a win-win strategy is what I'm hearing from you, which is the regulatory environment comes down a little bit. The entrepreneur or the business owners have more room to grow. They adopt a mindset of sharing profits, and the government wins on wage taxes alone. Yeah. So it's an ecosystem.
I'd like to point out, and again, I'm using my experiences, when you only got 200 or up to 300 employees, you know everyone singly. You don't need a lot of rules. You don't need a lot of, you know, you gotta pay the ones which work harder a little more money than the ones which work harder and smarter, give me a little more. You got to do that. Otherwise, there's no way you can build something, right? And you got to be respectful to it, et cetera, et cetera. I only say the profit sharing should be when the small companies, and I classify small companies below 300 employees. And my recommendation is, when I like to talk to all the small businesses, if you band together. You know, small business, we should also state, has always been the backbone of Canada. You know, the entrepreneurs, the owners, the commitment, the hustle. Okay, it's always been, right? So we got to make sure. So I'm saying to small business, if you band together, if you work together, band together, you could eliminate the red tape, because there's so much red tape that it chokes small business. So you could eliminate the red tape. And then you shouldn't be paying a business tax. Because, you know, when the tax people sometimes come in and the books and why this, why that, how come there's a restaurant, there's a coffee, you write it off against the, you know, it's enormous. So small business should pay no business tax, because small business wants to grow. That means if they want to grow, they hire an employee or two or three, okay? And this, the government makes the most money by income tax, right? And if the small businessman takes tax monies out, he also pays an income tax, right? Sure. So there should be no business tax. And that, if we be able to do that, if we get that across, we would have an economic boom of under proportions. But two rules would have to apply. Workplace safety, we don't want to see that somebody, the equipment is unsafe, loses some fingers or hand or whatever. So workplace safety is important, and you cannot dump, and the environment is important. You cannot dump poison chemicals in your backyard. So, but we don't need a lot of rules. Let's go back the way Canada was about 50 years ago. Like there was no problem. We were so productive. We just had great businesses, and it's diminishing now, right?
So from the time you were building a factory in a new town, you showed up, you said, hey, I want to build a factory here, to the time that you were maybe had some employees on the floor. How long was that? Back then, 50 years ago?
Well, no, that's maybe a year, 2 years, you know. And I just built a new factory in the area, right? And the factory is only half out, so I got a bill in the mail for $1,900,000. So I called the township. What's that for? Yeah, that's the thing that we allow you to build a factory in our town. Okay, so I said, you got to be kidding. No, that's what it is, right? So that's the dilemma, huh?
Yes.
We didn't have that years ago, right? I mean, because we simplified things, huh? So it takes, so small business is the most important thing, right? Because it would create an economic boom. So it's really, let's give the small business, let's give them the freedom to create things, huh? So that is the number two principle, to reduce the bureaucracy, right? And of course we need some, but we don't come in with a chain. I don't recommend a chainsaw approach that we fire people. So we have a reduction on hiring, right? Till we have the proper proportion, huh? So that's the number two principle.
So first one is reducing the debt and over 20 years, 5% a year.
Yes.
Second one is we're going to reduce bureaucracy with a hiring freeze until it naturally kind of takes its way.
Exactly.
Okay. And now, what's your principle number three?
The principle number three is we have tax system, which is so convoluted, huh? Like there's thousands, the tax book is, it's got 3,000 pages. It's about 3-4 inches thick. And it's just a huge, huge thing. And when you look into that, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of convoluted paragraphs, which nobody understands. When I have a lawyer in lunch or what, I show him for the fun of it. I say, can you explain that there's paragraph so-and-so? He reads it 10 times, says, no, it's unexplainable. So we have a system like that. Why do we have that? I believe it caters special interest groups. They have hundreds of thousands of tax specialists to find loopholes. What are we going to do to avoid taxes or pay low taxes? So I see a tax system black and white. Black and white, and which a high school student could fill out, right? If you make more monies, you pay more taxes, right? But no loopholes, huh? Because to me, it's amazing because there is recently, it was quite a bit on the news, capital gains tax. Income is income is income. It shouldn't matter where it comes from. If you have more and more income, you pay more taxes. That's the way it should be, right? Because the divide between the rich, the very rich, and the workers, it gets deeper and deeper. And that's because we have a tax system which benefits special interest groups.
Do we have that little tidbit article of the tax system anywhere here?
Oh, yes.
I would love to read that.
I would love to read it
because it is.
I have it here. It's such a. I got it here. It's such a.
We'll clip it out.
If you read that, I mean, everybody would shake that. It's the
all
middle
right.
of the black
so
type.
So the middle thing here. So this is point three on simplifying our tax system. I'm going to read a subsection out of the Canadian Tax Code. So subsection 18.1 brackets 10 applies where a taxpayer's particular right to receive production to which a matchable expenditure brackets other than an expenditure, no portion of which would, if this section were read without reference to subsections 18.1 bracket 7 and 18.1 bracket 10, be deductible under subsection 18.1 bracket 3 in computing the taxpayer's income, relates has expired over the or the taxpayer has disposed of all of the right otherwise than in a disposition to which subsection 87 bracket 1 or 88 bracket 1 applies.
Yeah. I think you could read it 10 times and still find no conclusion. It happens too. I had smart lawyers read that thing over.
Right. But
it's very important that you run a small business, that you're faced with that. You just want to bring it across to it and look, how come we have that?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
So anyway, so we need a tax system which is black and white. Okay. So that's was number three, right, on the principle. And the number four principle, we talked a lot about it, is small business should be, we got to eliminate the red tape, and the small business should not pay business tax. And really, it can operate on the, call it, what I would call the free enterprise system. We got to realize without free enterprise, there's no free society. So we only want to save the capitalistic system because free enterprise is the foundation for the capitalistic system.
So what does that mean, Frank? Sorry to interrupt you. But without free enterprise, there's no free society. Maybe we can talk just a quick second on that sentence.
Well, there's no free society if governments tell you, no, you cannot do this, you cannot that, and let the entrepreneurs, let the smart people, think about it. What can we do? What products can we make better?
Understood.
Okay?
Yes.
So it's really producing things, huh? And we got to realize companies which don't produce anything or import more and more and export less and less, the living standard will deteriorate enormously. And that's another dilemma Canada has at this time. If there's a new factory built, it's not the factory to make things, it's a warehouse. And old factories got converted to warehouses again. So we import more and more, and we export less and less, and we cannot make things anymore. It's a real dilemma.
Big time.
So anyway, the small business is free enterprise, and you operate under that thing. It's pure capitalistic system. But when you grow from a small business over 300 employees, then by law you have to share the profits with the employees.
Right.
So it's we're not killing the capitalistic system. When it's large, we put a harness on, right?
Yes.
Okay, you cannot put it all in your pockets. You got to share with the workers, because without the workers, you can't make a profit. But again, when you be a smaller thing, you don't need that, huh? You don't need any. You interface, the employees should know you. You got to interface with them. If they don't respect you, you don't make it, all right? Because any time when I went to work every day, the employees respect me.
Right.
Okay?
So let's talk about the word capitalism for a minute.
Yeah.
Okay? Some people may look at that word and say, oh, that's a bad word, capitalistic. What is this capitalist? You know, it's the rich making money and the poor not making money and et cetera. What do you have to say to a proper good capitalistic system? Why do you feel we should keep that together, and how is it actually a good thing?
Well, it's got this major flaw, huh? It's got the major flaw, and as I started out with, the world has always been dominated by the golden rule or by the capitalistic system, right? Okay, the capitalist naturally generations ago was the king. Okay.
Yes.
So it was always dominated and still is. So, but it's so creative. It's so free enterprise. It's to create wealth, right? The problem with the socialistic and communistic system is their philosophies are based on wealth distribution.
Yes.
Okay. The problem is, societies like that, they're not creating wealth. Okay, first you got to create the wealth. Otherwise, there's nothing to distribute.
Right.
We gotta teach that in the schools. We gotta teach, but we don't teach in schools how people could be free, right? And if you're not economically free, you're not really a free person, right? And it's a shame that so few Canadians are economically free. Let me talk quickly. What are the minimum standards of being economically free? I think if you work for 30 years, you should be able that you own your own little house. And you should be able to have maybe $100,000 in the bank to subsidize your pension in case whatever you want to, if you want to choose your own road to happiness, because when you work that many years, we all have certain outlook and we have all certain likings. Let it be. Let everybody be. Let everybody choose their own road to happiness, and do not prevent that other people also can choose their own road to happiness. But now we have the pensioners are worried, huh? Because their money, the way everything goes, they can't. We create more worries, huh? What a shame, right? By working that thing, you should have it a little easier, be happy. And so we got to change the society. We got to change the system. So I want to say it loud and clear. We got to change the system. We got to make, we got to make capitalists out of the workers.
Right. So you're saying let the companies grow. Let them hire people. Let the government get the taxes off that. And when the companies get to a size that they're so big, put in a constitution that it makes them that
profit sharing.
Profit shares.
Yes.
Right? Which then again pays the employees more money, which then again the government ends up getting more taxes on.
Yes.
So it works quite well.
Yeah, it's you gotta be innovative, right? Okay. I mean, you gotta be innovative, and you gotta, if employees are happy, if they know they get a portion of they think differently, right? the attitude is differently. So it, this way, together as a country, we create more wealth. Wonderful. And all I'm saying again is, let workers are entitled to get a piece of the economic pie.
Fair. Okay. So now we're on what, principle four, principle five here?
Principle five, that's a relative easy one, by not existing companies, like small companies getting into large companies above 300 employees, by law, automatically you have to share the profits with the workers. Okay. So that's a straightforward, that's a simple thing here. So the next number, the sixth principle is, I'm saying high school should end at grade 10, and then grade 11 and grade 12. I think we should expose our kids to the trades. I think this would be a win for our students, our kids, because it would give them more knowledge. And life is really to accumulate knowledge. The more knowledge you accumulate, the more knowledge you accumulate, the better you could do, right? So it's a win for the students. The knowledge has increased. It's a win for society because it's so difficult to find tradesmen, right? Everybody wants to be a lawyer or a financial accountant, right? Because those are very, a lot of government jobs are available in that category.
Right. No, that'll be very helpful.
So that's the principle number six, right? And I think the principle seven is very dear to my heart, right? The principle seven is no Canadian kid should go to school hungry. That means breakfast has to be served. No Canadian kid should leave the school hungry. That means lunch has got to be served. And by law, the food would have to be organic, okay? And that brings up another dilemma, because family farms, small business and family farms were the backbone of Canada. A country which could feed itself never had a problem, but we can't do that anymore. You know, family farmers are practically on welfare. And kids of family farmers say, Mom, Dad, I don't want to be in a farming. I don't want to be on welfare. So I think it's crucial that we have a family farm foundation where we could support family farms. Okay, about 15 years ago, I decided to get out of the large car business, and I don't want to be a hypocrite, right? But when I was younger, I hustled to make some money so I can live in dignity, and most entrepreneurs, they're in the same boat. They want to hustle, make some money, so he can live in integrity. But the more I got into the farming and the agriculture, the more I could see the problem, the more I could see all the chemicals we eat. Huh? When we got to realize 95% of the food eaten in North America comes from industrial farms. In industrial farms, you see no more eagles fly. Why? There's no more rabbits. There's no more pheasants. We spray so much fungicide and pesticides, we kill everything. You know, that gets in the air, we breathe the air, gets in the water, we drink the water, gets into the soil, we eat the food. People have no idea how much chemicals they eat. And one of the reasons I got into that thing, because I said, look, what's the purpose of life, right? I think it's a sad thing if you have no purpose. The purpose should be, could you be helpful to make it a better site? Could you help somebody which is in more need than yourself, okay? That's what life is all about. And that brings me to another subject, right? And I was being very critical on myself, you know, the last 5 years. Why? I've been on the boards of university, I think about 7 or 8 universities in the States, in Canada, in Europe. And I did my usual thing as a board of directors, XXX. But only dawned on me the last number of years that what's the mandate of a university? The mandate of a university is to teach young people how can we have a more civilized society. Or to be more specific, we universities would be the ideal institutions where we could develop structures which would lead to an ideal society. We have absolutely no blueprint. You're a builder, you know, you would never build a house without a blueprint.
That's correct.
We have no. Look, we have great faculties in the universities in regards to medicine, to technologies, to the arts, but very little faculties in regards to humanity. Okay, it's the golden rule. We don't want to teach people how to be free, because if we teach people how to be free, we cannot manipulate them.
Yep, start thinking for themselves.
As we do now.
Yep.
Okay, so that's the way I see the world, okay? That's what drives me. The unfortunate part about this, and again, there's always people which have good ideas, a good mind, and I've been guided by one politician, or I would call him a statesman, by Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, in his later years, he kept saying, goddamn politicians, goddamn politics, parliament doesn't work. There's only politicians in there. So Churchill said, we need a chamber of citizens to balance out the politics. Okay? But I know a lot of politicians, they mean well. Okay? Agreed. Good guys, they want to change the system, but they can't. Because we have a system, whoever comes forward with a new idea will be defeated, because you can always, you find more problems if, you know, and if you create something new, then so the system is just like run always. It's like it's been run for the last 60, 70, 80 years, right? Don't bring forward something new. That's the first thing when a young politician, when he gets a lecture from the older, but you can't say that because we won't be elected.
Right.
So we got it. So the economic charter does not come from politicians. So they might go for that, huh?
Right.
The very important thing is this should be a grassroots movement, okay? I'm fortunate. You know, I could not do that early on because I had an obligation to the Magna shareholders. And I knew when I would bring forward some of those ideas, I knew I would wind up with some poisonous arrows in my back. But I have a certain age. I follow my conscience. And I know I will die happy because I've done the right thing. Good Canada thing. Is a great country. And again, my recommendation to the young Canadians would be focus on the day to stay alive, but leave the door open for tomorrow and follow your conscience and be guided. Be guided. Follow your dreams and be guided by your conscience.
Wonderful.
Let me repeat that because this is one of my most important advice I give, right? So when you get older, you know, you tell the younger people, focus on today to stay alive, but leave the door open for tomorrow. And follow your dreams and be guided by your conscience. And share the wealth with the more needy. But the great thing about the Economic Charter of Rights would be, I'm very confident we would eliminate poverty. That's what it's all about.